Welcome to the Transcontinental Race Podcast, Finding Its Way with Komoot, the home of those who go further. Komoot's the ultimate route planner and navigation app that helps you explore more.
On a terrace overlooking the beach in Brest, the Transcontinental Finishers Party is getting underway. The riders look like a cult as they crowd round in their caps. In the 2 weeks they've been wearing them, the numbers have started to fade, and the white that once gleamed against the grey has been browned by the battering of the road. Everyone's standing around the steps outside the bar. Transcontinental Race Director Anna Haslock and Race Coordinator Rory Kemper are getting ready to say a few words. Soon they'll invite winner Fiona Kolbinger, runner-up Ben Davis, and the first pair, Esben Nutner Landgraf and Emmanuel Verde, to the stage. But first, a man who's been inventing weird and wonderful monikers for himself and entertaining us on this podcast is stepping up to open the proceedings.
So if you listen to the podcast, you might have recognized my sultry voice. I'm Cap85, also known as the Wilted Salad or, you know, the Frumpy Tortoise, just saying welcome to Brest. Most of us were greeted by the beautiful Brest weather of headwind and blistering rain, so most of us look like we came in wet sanded and look like we jumped in a pool. So I'm just here to welcome everybody here and also thanks everybody for participating and coming out. I'm super thankful. We should give a big round of applause to the Lost Dot crew.
So first of all, we wanted to just thank all of you guys. Thank you for racing. Also want to thank everybody who's still out on the road and for the guys who've scratched and who've had to go home to real life already. You know, we want to say thank you to those guys as well.
And glasses were raised in honour of the founder of the Transcontinental, Mike Hall.
We have to remember Mike and thank Mike. Without his creativity and vision, none of us would be here. And yeah, I know that we all remember him and thanks, Mike.
The first rider to be invited up to the stage was this year's winner, Fiona Kolbinger.
Thanks so much for this experience. It was unique and I loved it. And I think we are all part of this. And yeah, thanks so much to the TCR for being there.
Fiona was relatively unknown in the cycling world, but when avid dot watchers studied her Strava page, things started to look interesting.
So I went to her Strava profile and I noticed she'd been qualifying for Paris-Brest-Paris. And she'd done a lot of other long rides as well. And the average speeds were anything between 25 and 30 k's an hour.
Grace Lambert-Smith rode TCR number 5, but had to scratch due to the heat.
I was like, wow, this girl's quick. And her time off the bike was also low. So she did a 600 with just 5 hours off the bike and a 400 with 1.5 hours off the bike. So I was like, wow, she's really efficient too. So you've got quick, efficient. And then some of these rides were really hilly as well. So I was like, wow, she's also really powerful. And it was kind of cool that she was under the radar and just chipped away. You know, she didn't have to take time off the bike to update her followers of what she was doing or what she was feeling or what her goals were for the next 24 hours. She just got on with it and it was amazing to see. And I saw riders like complaining about the heat, and it's so for her to just power through all of those conditions and do well out of it was just amazing. And I think everyone agrees that it was a real tough race this year. The parkours were really difficult, lots of gravel and steep climbs. And the stats that one of the guys in the Transcontinental Facebook group was putting together, Jürgen, I think over the 4,000 kilometres that she rode, she averaged 24 k's an hour, like all in.
If you've been following this podcast, you will have heard her arriving at Control Point 1, surprised to be told that she was in 5th place. Then we caught up with her at Control Point 2, where as the riders were arriving, a wedding was reaching its crescendo.
So I had 3 punctures and crashed twice today, once on the parkour when I couldn't clip out fast enough, and once at the border between Bulgaria and Serbia. So there was another rider standing right next to the border barrier, and wow, that's getting loud here. So there was another rider standing right next to the border barrier. He was on the toilet or something. I was waving, looking to the side. I didn't see the barrier, so I crashed right into it. I fell, so little skin on my elbows is off, but feels okay. So the border barrier was bent, so it was a damage done to the Serbian people, I would say. So the border police confiscated my passport. And actually, it took me like half an hour until I could continue. So I was always like, hey, I'm on a race. How long is it going to take? And they were like, oh, we need to call our boss to know what we are doing now. We don't know what's happening now because we've never had this before, anyone crashing into this barrier.
After the race, I sat down with Fiona, away from the madness of the road, to reflect on her win. Get yourself comfortable as we go into how it unfolded and the reaction to her success. We begin her story at Control Point 2. Before the TCR, Fiona had been riding with the then race favourite Bjorn Lennart in Dresden, Germany. Bjorn had been out in the lead for the first day and a half of the race, but when Fiona arrived at Control Point 2, Bjorn was sitting there wearing a towel. His race had been ended by saddle sores. You'd arrived there, Bjorn, who you had trained with and ridden with in the lead up to it, was standing there, having scratched. So what was that like? Did you know that he had scratched at that point?
So at that point, we had been in touch, messaging on the phone, like how it's going and how we are feeling. And I knew that he had some saddle sores. Actually, we had already talked about that in Burgas at the start. So I knew that he had been away, I think, in the States for a couple of weeks and also cycling there because he doesn't travel without his bike. So he had some, I think, old shorts with him, and it just didn't go well. So, so I knew that he had some troubles with that already in the lead up to the race, and he started, well, with some troubles already. So I knew that he wasn't unaffected by saddle sores at that point. But I was certainly not expecting to see him. So actually, I thought he would really push through, and I was also trying to cheer him up and like telling him, hey, just go on, just try to find a pharmacy maybe, and maybe they're able to help you. So I actually expected him, so as far as I got to know him to that point, I would have thought he would push through. But of course, I also didn't know the severity of his saddle sores and like how bad it really was, which is something only he can tell, right? So I was really surprised to see him. Then Bjorn stayed there, so I was leaving third. And actually then just a kilometer or two outside of CP2, I saw another rider sitting there. So I thought, okay, so now I'm number two, apparently, yeah.
And then from that point, it was just Jonathan Rankin that was ahead of you. So what did that feel like?
So when I kind of realized I'm in the top three overall right now, and I'm chasing him, I mean, it didn't really feel like I was chasing him because it still felt like, oh, you need to finish first, right? It's like, there is such a long journey ahead of you still, so you just need to finish first. Just don't get in that race mode right now. But then the next night after I reached CP2 is also pretty interesting because I had to buy some food, so I went to a gas station. Once I left the gas station with my food, it started pouring down. It was really a torrential downpour. And I thought, okay, well, it's now 11:30. I'm already feeling a bit tired, so why not lie down instead of getting soaked? So I lay down for 2 hours, and it was really a bit of a shady place where I lay down. It was at a motel was right next door. There were buses with people partying. They were pretty drunk, and I was just lying down in that shed in my sleeping bag for 2 hours. I woke up before my alarm rang because a bus was driving up. But when I woke up, I realized it wasn't raining anymore, and I felt pretty fresh. So I thought, why not continue now? So that was what I did. And actually, without realizing it, without checking track leaders, I seem to have taken the lead accidentally in that night. So that was on day three and in Serbia. And then in the morning, my eyelids just fell down, so I needed to sleep for 2 more hours, around 9 to 11, I think. And then I was second again, but I knew that I was really close to Jonathan. And I think that was the moment where I started checking track leaders frequently and like really like checking how far he is in front of me. And and then actually that night when I crossed into Austria from Slovenia, that was also pretty interesting. So I think that was one of my longest days. I did 475 kilometers in that day, and I just crossed into Austria. So I only crossed the Austrian border, and I I slept in at a campsite at the, in that night. It wasn't manned at that time anymore. It was raining as well, and I was waking up at about 3 or 4. It was pretty early, actually. And then I woke up, packed my stuff, got on the bike, and about 20 minutes later, I saw some red rear lights in front of me, and that was Ben Davies at that point, because he had also caught up with us. So I saw Ben, and then we had a nice chat, and it was just really nice. We cycled next to each other for about 15 minutes, and then I took a left turn, and he went straight. And then I would never see Ben again after that. And then there was a lake in Austria, and Ben went south of the lake, and Jonathan and me, we took a route north. And then I saw some red rear lights in front of me again, and I was like, wow, that must be Jonathan. So I tried to keep the pace and tried to not lose sight of his rear light. And then suddenly it was gone. So he must have turned or maybe went to the bathroom somewhere. So he was just gone. And then the next time I checked track leaders, I was ahead of him. So I thought, yeah, that's great now. That's really great. And then a couple of hours later, he scratched. And I saw his number on track leaders fading. So I was really surprised to read that.
It's so interesting hearing it from your perspective, having been dot watching, because when you had that night that you stayed in the quite shady place and overtook mm-hmm. him because you didn't really want to sleep, we were looking at it and thinking, she's done an attack.
No, that was really, I overtook the lead by accident. And at that point, really in my head, I was not in race mode yet, I would say. So I think that switch happened somewhere in Slovenia, I think between Slovenia and Austria, when I really realized, wow, I made it through the flat. So my fear was always getting beaten by them in the flat, because I know that I'm pretty good in the mountains, but I always thought I was comparably weak in the flat. Yeah, so that was my fear, but it didn't happen. So once we reached Austria and I knew it would get hillier soon, I was just really happy to be in that position, and it was so rewarding to climb those mountains. It's always a joy if you push up a mountain and you get nice views and the weather is great. So I also think I was really lucky with the weather. So I heard that a few riders coming just a couple of hours after me got caught in a thunderstorm that I could avoid, and I was just really lucky with that.
And so you went into first place, and as you pushed on with that lead, I imagine that more and more messages started coming in on your phone. What was that like? Is that helpful?
Actually, I started feeling the media interest and the media presence when I crossed. It was just coincidentally the exact moment when I crossed from Croatia into Slovenia. So I crossed that border, and so I have that connection between my phone and my Garmin via Bluetooth. So I see all the messages on my Garmin as well. And then suddenly, once I crossed that border, a ton of messages, like really an unspoken amount of messages, started popping up on my Garmin. I couldn't see the route anymore. So I stopped, had a look at my phone, and saw that it was all Strava messages. So it was like new followers on Strava. And I checked, and I had like 600 new followers in that very moment. And I had thought that it was actually something like "Welcome to Slovenia" by my phone provider, but it wasn't. And then it just became more and more, and I switched off the notifications on my phone. And then at some point, also WhatsApp messages started flooding in, and emails and everything, and it became pretty overwhelming. So I decided to switch my phone off because I didn't need it for navigation, and really I just wanted to keep in touch with very few persons at that time. So I think I messaged to some groups that I had created beforehand. I messaged that I'm like now not messaging anymore, and that I'm kind of a bit overwhelmed by it all, and that I'm switching it off. So I just wanted to enjoy the race in the end. So it kind of got me a bit away from the actual purpose of my ride. Yeah.
I could completely imagine that, because in the lead up you were probably looking forward to the journey across all of these countries and this sort of tranquility of the bits when you'd be riding at night and alone, and then to suddenly have lots of people vying for your attention must have been quite a shock.
Exactly, that's it. And it's also complete stranger. So that night in Austria, I had two marriage requests in my mailbox. It was WhatsApp messages, so apparently someone must have given someone my phone number. It was just, it felt really weird. And yeah, so I'm happy I could enjoy it after all with a phone that was switched off.
I have to ask you that a lot of the media coverage around the race has been to do with the fact that you are the first female overall winner of this race. And a lot of it was talking about how it felt like at some point a woman would win the TCR. It felt like an inevitability rather than a possibility. As a woman doing endurance sport, do you think that there is a level playing field that is brought about by the longer duration of these sorts of events?
So I think the TCR community is very aware of the fact that in such races, it doesn't only come down to the physical ability to ride your bike fast and far, but it just comes down to a good route planning. It comes down to being able to sleep little, being able to have only very short rest stops, being organized about your food choices, being quick in supermarkets and gas stations, just not losing time, and also being good at bike maintenance. So there is so many aspects to it that don't have anything to do with testosterone levels or physical circumstances that are bound to the gender. So I think this is why the TCR community and the Dot Watchers and everyone watching this race is very clear that this is actually less of a miracle than it might seem to people who have only watched Tour de France and shorter bike races, in which it really comes down more to being able to ride fast for a short amount of time.
You must feel proud. Do you now feel that there's a sense of representing women in a way?
Of course, I do feel so. And I got a lot of encouraging words from men and women alike on the road. So all the Dot Watchers that joined me for a couple of kilometers on their bikes, it was men and women alike. And everyone was very cheerful about equal opportunities and gender equality in this sport. And I think we should really all try to make that come true. I mean, we are still not there, even though the TCR community is a great exception, and I feel like no one is really questioning this here. But out in the world, it's still different, as we all know. And so I of course feel like I'm a bit of a women's ambassador now. Yeah, which feels great, but I'm very keen to take on that task, and yeah, it feels good.
And so with the media attention, it's been quite phenomenal, really. How has that been for you?
It was annoying while I was on the road, to be very honest with you. I would have wished for a bit more respect by the journalists during the last two or three days. It got a bit overwhelming, to be honest. It feels really disrespectful when, after being on the bike for 15 hours, someone is sticking a camera into your face without asking you beforehand. So that was something that really hindered me from enjoying my ride as much as I could have. But now afterwards, it has all been very respectful, and of course, the media interest. It's okay. I understand very well that people are excited about the winner and want to get to know a person, especially given there was just not a lot of information to find about me on the web. So, yeah, that seems to have been a huge question mark about who I actually am and like where I come from, because I seem to have appeared from nowhere, right? I understand that there is some interest, but I would have wished for journalists to be a bit more respectful while I was still racing and hadn't finished yet. I mean, they were all celebrating me like a winner, and many people were congratulating me already on the road, which was something I just didn't understand, because I hadn't reached the finish line at that point yet.
Because whenever people talk about riding something like the TCR, they always say that the first goal is just to finish it. And so I can imagine that, yeah, sure, you don't want to make any assumptions. Yeah. You described that moment when a flurry of messages started to come in, and the excitement around you being the leader was really ramping up. At what point did you allow yourself to start thinking that you might win?
As soon as I took the lead in Austria, I would say, because I realized that there were mountains coming up, which is my strength. And I realized that over the last 1,000 kilometers approximately, there had been nobody who was taking over the lead from me or who was significantly faster than I was. And also there was not a lot of people coming behind. So the fourth place was always in pretty far behind the first three of us, Ben, Jonathan and me. Yeah, so that's actually when I realized that I'm now leading and I can push and maybe win it. But yeah, I always had in the back of my head that still there's a lot of distance to go. And especially that last stretch through France felt really long because there's just not a lot going on a Sunday in France. And I really had a hard time finding food, for example. But I think in Austria, that was it.
I think if it was me, I might start to panic a little bit at that point under the pressure. How were you?
It was fine. No, I really didn't find myself in any pressure because most of the time I spent alone on the road as it had been before. So not much had changed besides the fact that I knew I was leading it. But I still pedaled. My legs were still fine and it didn't feel any different. So yeah, that was good.
And then one of the most amazing moments from a spectator's point of view was then, having left CP3, you arrived at CP4 and played the piano.
Yeah, so to be honest, I'm really not a pianist, actually. So I play the violin and the viola, but that piano playing was really, like, just... I know that this was maybe one of the moments people loved most about my race, but it was really nothing I thought about a lot, so yeah.
I think I loved seeing it because it was really surprising, because I talked to the riders and so often they talked to me about having cramps in their hands and rider's palsy and things like that, and it made me think, you're obviously very comfortable on the bike, or at least your hands are if you're able to do that. And then also to have the mental dexterity to go from riding to doing that is not an easy thing to do. It was very impressive to see.
Yeah, I think I was really clear in my head at all times. So I talked to a rider yesterday and they were like, wow, how did you manage that? And like, how did you feel? And I said, actually, at any time in the race, I could have phoned my employer and talked about a contract or so. So actually, I felt really fresh at all times. So that was maybe why I just followed my feeling of sitting down at the piano at that point. I didn't think about it at all. And I am really happy to still have feeling in my hands, because I did have rider's palsy on London, Edinburgh, London 2 years ago, where I didn't have any aero bars or anything. This time it was just really important to me because I will be starting to work as a surgeon in September. And, well, obviously that is a problem if you don't have any feeling in your hands.
A lot of the articles have said that you're a cancer researcher. Is that incorrect?
It is not incorrect. So I just finished medical school in the beginning of May. During medical school, I have done some cancer research. So right now I'm interested in the surgical aspects of cancer therapy. So, cutting the cancer out, which is a very effective way of treating tumors. So I'm a doctor by profession. I'm 24 years old and I am also a young cancer researcher.
What sort of things did you find yourself thinking about whilst you were riding the race?
Oh, I actually spend quite a substantial amount of time calculating stuff on the bike, calculating how many kilometers I have left, how many kilometers it is until the next bigger city, how much that would be in miles, and what speed I would need to go to reach that place in a certain amount of time. And then in the end, I don't really think I'm pondering so much about my own life or my friends or family, but rather just having that emptiness in my head. So really, I'm not thinking a lot, but enjoying what is around me. And and sometimes I'm just really speechless and maybe thoughtless because of the beauty of the landscape I'm cycling through. So yeah, not a lot.
And so you're going on to ride Paris-Brest-Paris now. So how do you think that's going to feel after doing this ride?
Yeah, good question. I have no idea. I mean, when I was planning those two rides kind of back to back, I was always only thinking about the TCR. So Paris-Brest-Paris was always, oh, well, that's far behind TCR. I just need to finish that one first and then the rest is going to feel easy. And so by now, I mean, my legs have recovered. I'm sitting here in my cycling gear and I'm about to do a small spin around Brest. And I'm feeling pretty good, actually. So actually, I'm also planning to ride back to Paris from Brest. So I'm doing Burgers, Brest, Paris this summer, which is even, making it a bit more stupid. But I feel great, and I'm looking forward to it. Apparently, it's a completely different thing than the TCR. It's non-competitive, and I'm really looking forward to the Audax aspect of it. So talking to people, drafting a little bit, then sitting in a group, having lunch, just sitting down for food. It's a lot more relaxed than the TCR, and especially because it's non-competitive, I have 90 hours to complete it, which feels like a huge amount of time after the TCR. So I really do it just to enjoy it, and the Paris-Brest-Paris is just like a huge party, and I'm happy to be part of that party.
So you said that you're soon going to be starting work as a surgeon. Is there any temptation that if you could hold that off for a little while and do a bit more cycling before then that you would do that?
Well, that's a dangerous question, and I know that there are some people in the clinic following the TCR as well. So I need to think about what I'm saying now. Yeah, no, I don't think I would ever do cycling as a commercial activity. So I would never want to be paid for it, because it's just a great hobby for me. And I also know why I studied medicine, because I love that job. And I am excited and nervous about how I'm going to be able to combine both, as cycling is a bit more than just a hobby for me. Obviously, I mean, as much as I didn't expect to win the TCR, I knew that cycling should always be a big part of my free time. And I'm aware of the fact that my free time might be a bit more limited while I'm working as a doctor and working shifts, for example. So I'm excited to see how the future evolves, but I would never do cycling as a commercial activity or as a professional rider, I think.
Thank you. It's been so nice talking to you.
Thanks so much.
Back in the square in Brest, the second rider to reach the finish, Ben Davis, was called up to the stage to say a few words.
This is my third time on the TCR, and it's sort of, I'm really proud to sort of be here in second position. But Fiona, what you've done this year is just incredible, and hopefully what you've done for our sport will sort of keep coming through over the next few years. That's a really positive thing.
I sat down with Ben to talk about how he built on last year's 10th place to climb to second.
This is basically a culmination of a year's worth of work, really, from my side. I came out of last year's TCR, finished 10th, and had made some pretty fundamental mistakes. So, but I knew that I had some legs. So I spent a lot of time this year getting stronger, and getting ready for TCR this year. So,
and when you say fundamental mistakes, because as far as I'm aware from last year, there was a routing issue.
Yep.
Was there anything else that you felt that you needed to improve on?
Yeah, so I think in terms of a solid block of time lost last year, it was a routing issue. But it's all the little things about how you manage your sleep and your eating. And so last year it was very much, you stop at a petrol station, I'll eat my food at the petrol station, I'll chill out a little bit. And that's like, as a single item, it's a very small amount of time. But when you build all of those up over 10, 12 days, whatever it might be, that's like a significant amount of time. So I think it's those little things that you can bring and sort of improve on. But to be honest, I think this year I'm just a lot stronger. Like, I trained a lot harder and in a much more structured way. I've got a pretty intensive workload, so fitting training around that, it's brought a lot more structure to it this year, which I think has really been productive for me. I mean, the way I've approached it is both very much endurance-based miles plus intensity. To an extent, I do it that way to fit around my work commitments. So you do weekdays, high intensity, shorter duration, weekends, longer duration, lower intensity. That's just like a sensible approach to it. I think if I had more free time, there'd be a slight tweak there. But high intensity is still really useful for endurance.
One of the things that got me quite worried watching you in the race was that Bjorn had scratched because of saddle sores.
Yeah.
We had a lot of riders that were struggling with it, and it was something that meant that you had to stand up and ride out of the saddle for quite a large proportion of your ride. I mean, how was that, and how did you manage to get over that?
It's so unfortunate, I think, that both myself and Bjorn got pretty, well, I think Bjorn to a much more extent, but both pretty significant saddle sores, because we're both, well, definitely from my perspective, same saddle, same position, same chamois, so there shouldn't have been any issue there. But what I think it was 6 a.m. start. I always had it in my head that I'm riding into the second night before stops, so it's always going to be a long stint. It was, I think my first stint was like 40 hours, so I think it was like 820k, something like that, was the first off in sweaty bibs, and that's probably what led to the problem. But in terms of managing it, you had to be a bit clever about it. So I ended up stopping for an hour for a shop to open to get some running shorts so I could wear them for a morning, just to get some air downstairs. And then it was basically a couple of days sitting in a nappy of Sudocrem. And so it's incredibly painful, but it was one of these things. It was, I found that if I got in a position and didn't move, I could be comfortable enough. And I also pulled some pretty funny shapes on the saddle, I think. So,
are you comfortable now?
Yeah. So it was really funny. So I had 2 days of extreme pain, and then it sort of tapered off towards the end of the race. And towards the end, everything was hardening up, and it was sore for other reasons. But it got pretty crispy.
So we talked during the race about the fact that you prefer to bivvy. One of the things with bivvying is that you don't go to bed in a hotel room that has a sink that you can wash your shorts in. Yeah. So do you take care to do that? Or is that something that, you know, isn't really possible when you're bivvying?
Yeah, no, you're completely right. I think bivvying is a lot less hygienic, so you don't shower. And I think this year I washed. So I have two bib shorts, both got washed once. So it's pretty unhygienic. So that probably did contribute to saddle soreness, which is a bit of a shame. But I think the positives for me personally outweigh the negatives. And yes, I had an issue on this race. Previously, I've never had an issue with the less hygienic nature of bivvying. So I probably will go away and have a think about it, but probably won't change much.
One of the things that I've really been impressed by with your race was the absolute grit with which you got on with that. You've been pretty tough throughout this race to hold that position in second, and it was really impressive to watch. So it feels like not only your physical fitness, but your mental fitness seems very strong.
No, I really appreciate that, because I think it's the mental strength on TCI is like nearly as important as physical strength, or as important as physical strength.
The last riders up were the winning pair, Espen Newton Landgraf and Emmanuel Verde.
Thanks so much.
The race coordinator, Rory Kemper, introduced them.
It's been an interesting race, really, with the pairs competition. And I spoke to Espen earlier today just to kind of get a bit of a background of them. They've been kind of quietly just kind of working their way through the pairs. So I kind of said, oh, like, tell me a little bit about you, like, what happened? And he was like, oh, we from Oslo, and we started riding together. And then he was like, oh, we should do the TCR. So I asked if they were still friends. Apparently they are. Although he says there was one time that was really, really, like, almost the crack of the partnership was they were at the top of the second pass on Parkour 3. I believe Emmanuel wanted to stop. Espen was like, no, we've got to get down to the bottom. And they had a massive, massive row. They get to the bottom. I don't think they're still in agreement about who was right and who was wrong. But anyway, great race. They just clawed their way past loads of different people and did really well. Thank you.
It wasn't actually planned. Like, we didn't want to go for the first.
It wasn't part of our goals for the race or anything. I think our goals for the race were only to finish, and then to finish in as good a time as we could. And none of us expected to be able to be a first pair or win or anything. We didn't.
We didn't even check the checker before we were in the tracker before we were like in the fourth checkpoint, I think. That's where we like started to see where people were, and like we didn't see any pairs in front. So it was like one other pair very close to us. So we thought like, maybe we would like give them some competition. And from there on, we kind of kept checking the tracker and like, yeah, we should go for the first, we should go for the win.
I had this thought in the back of my mind, if we kind of discovered that we're close, we're in competition, maybe we would get kind of rash and make bad decisions or something. But
you're probably right about that, because one day I was like, we were very close to the other pair, and I kind of like started to think about my tactics and everything, and we actually like, I made a big mistake on like not sleeping too much. So Espen was like, we should just stop and we should do our thing, and then we probably get first anyway. And I think that was actually the right thing to do, but we like went for the more stressed approach, and I think we actually lost 3 hours that night, and the other pair actually went quite a bit in front.
Is that because you were riding slower because you'd had less sleep?
Exactly. So
And we actually stopped to sleep outside for a couple of hours, and then we went back on the bike, and then we discovered that we were basically falling asleep on the bike because we had had such a poor sleep, so we had to stop again and
unpack everything and get settled again.
And still not have very good sleep. So, but the day after that we rode pretty well, despite bad sleep. But if we had kind of stuck to our rhythm and slept inside, we'd have gone even further. I'm not sure.
So do you think the race was what you expected it to be?
It was much more than I expected it to be in many ways. Especially all of the people that we met along the way.
Yeah.
That was just... I expected to meet a lot of cool, interesting, friendly, nice people. But... To the extent, I wasn't prepared for the amount of great people.
That's insane.
The kind of relationships that develop along the way. You see one guy at the start, and then you see him later again in another country, like a couple of days later, and you kind of pick up the conversation, and about each other, and you're super excited to see each other after a long while, and it's very fun, and seeing them again at the party afterwards is just awesome.
As the Transcontinental draws to a close for this year, Anna and Rory will be adjudicating each rider's race and applying any penalties they've picked up to ensure the results are fair. Taking a microscope to every moment of everyone's race would be an impossible task without the wonderful people who give up their time by volunteering at the controls and spending hours dot-watching from home.
We could not do this race without our volunteers. I'm probably going to cry. Every year, I get a bit upset. Every year, I just feel like this is our family, you know. This is such a close community. And every year, you know, people come back or we meet new volunteers come in, and they give so much, you know. They give so much of their time, their energy, their enthusiasm. You know they're going to meet tired riders, and they don't take it personally if they're a bit kind of not communicative or whatever. And they cycle from all sort corners of Europe to come and join us at a control point. You know, and those are the ones you can see. You know, most of our volunteers are sitting at home behind a computer, tirelessly researching these dots, hours and hours of their time, you know, and they've all got family, job, whatever, 9 to 5, and the rest of the time they're just plugging away, checking on the dots, and, you know, you can't see them. But for our riders, they're like angels watching over us, you know, and I think the riders do feel a real sense of comfort from knowing that they've got a dot, and they never get to know who this dot watcher is, but they have their dot watcher who's keeping an eye on them. And, you know, and we adjudicate post-race. There's no way we could plough through 300 people's worth of riding properly and do a proper job of this without the dot watchers. And they're checking out what's happened, you know, they're looking at all the maps, they're doing all the research. It's like a well-oiled machine now. And honestly, like, they're so passionate about it and they care so very much about their riders. And yeah, so the big thing that I really want to do is thank them, you know, and just say, each and every one of you, you're amazing and we couldn't do it without you.
Thanks for listening to the Transcontinental Podcast, supported by Komoot. I'm Tom Bonnet and I'll be back at the beginning of October with coverage from the first edition of the Transcontinental's new race, the Trans Pyrenees. Please subscribe to hear all the drama as the riders race from the Bay of Biscay to the tip of the Cap de Creux in the Balearic Sea and back again. Until then, I'd like to say a huge thank you to everyone I've met in the making of this series for welcoming me into your world and sharing your stories.